Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on quacks and quackery when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from the time that we're children that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if your carpenter said he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Well, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or his own steps is incompetent? Well, you know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he said about our vaunted lawyers. He said, it's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. He said it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. Now, our school, Courtroom Strategy and Procedures, is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email. Just click on to our website first. And you can download that free general law CD package right off of our archives page. I want you to try that. That's georgegordon.org or georgegordon.com, the archives page, and then download that free general law CD package. Well, we took a look last time at the genius behind the American Medical Association and their attack on the alternative health care providers, the chiropractors and the vitamin industry. These guys have a monopoly. They want to preserve their monopoly. They work in conjunction with the pharmaceutical industry and the Medical Doctors of America. Those two commercial organizations have ties with the Food and Drug Administration, the Center for Disease Control, the Federal Trade Commission, the Post Office, and the National Institutes of Health. Now, these government institutions, along with these private money moneyed organizations are in business to make profit and gain. They're in business to control, to create, control, and operate a monopoly, a medical monopoly. Now, the people are dissatisfied with the medical monopoly, and nearly everybody that you talk to says the system's broken, it needs fixing. Well, yeah, that's right. And the solution is the government's going to take over healthcare and solve the problem. Now, from what we've been looking at, the government is about 90% of the problem. About 10% of it's just plain greed and business avarice. And about 90% of the regulation and control is caused by government. Now, government, when they come in to fix the problem, will create an even bigger problem than the one that they're trying to fix. It's the way they've always operated in the past. It's the way they're operating today, and it's what we could expect in the future. Now, I stay as far away from allopathic health care as I can get. It's got some products that are worth buying. I like to be the guy that decides what I want to buy, who I want to buy it from, and how much I want to pay. And I've done that in the past. Seems to work pretty well for me, and I'm not complaining about it. I don't want insurance. I don't want national health care insurance. I'm gonna opt out and let the rest of you people show me how good that is and how well it works. So I'll sit back and I'll watch you guys do it first, and then you let me know how good that thing works. Meanwhile, back on the farm, Eustace Mullins has done quite an expose here in this chapter 2, I believe it's chapter 2, dealing with quackery. And the American Medical Association gets to decide who the quacks are. They create the definition for quacks. Now, it's the AMA that fits the definition perfectly. But they set up a committee on quackery in 1962. Then they incorporated it. Then they used that, along with the government agencies, to attack every independent health care provider in the country and drove them out. Now all you've got left is the AMA. There are a few states that will allow, that license naturopaths. And, of course, the chiropractors won their case against the AMA in 1989, and now they're legal and lawful. And so the AMA failed in that goal there. But all of the vitamin companies, and they're after the vitamins, what they're trying to do is to get a register put together so that only the pharmaceutical companies can dispense vitamins. That's their next goal. They'll succeed at that. It'll take them some time, but they'll get it. And then they'll have one more monopoly, you know, one more piece to the monopoly game. Now, back in the early 1940s, ranking members of the AMA had come to the conclusion that much of their problems with their membership lay with the abrasive Morris Fishbein. Most doctors were ultra-conservative in their thinking, and they found Fishbein's antics repulsive. Nevertheless, he had spun his web at the AMA so fine that it involved everyone in headquarters. His power was built on censorship, intimidation, and exercise of his powers to the limit. It took his rivals almost a decade to get rid of him. Their opportunity came when Fishbein's able lieutenant, Dr. Olin West, became ill and was no longer able to maintain the kind of ironclad control of the AMA headquarters that he needed to for the Fishbein regime to remain in power. Apparently ignorant of the cabal against him, Fishbein continued his merry life of travel and recreation, continuing to garner many awards and prizes for his medical public relations work. He had been named an Officer of the Cross in the exclusive Order of Orange-Nassau, a very secretive organization which commemorated the invasion and takeover of England by William of Orange and the subsequent establishment of the Bank of England. Fishbein made frequent trips to England, where he was wined and dined by prominent members of the establishment. They must have believed that he could be of some use to them. However, none of these honors proved to be of any avail when the man who was described by Newsweek as the man with 100 enemies, which was surely the understatement of the year, he was thrown out even more unceremoniously than his predecessor, the unsavory quack, old Doc Simmons. Despite repeated public criticisms of his junkets and the blatant abuse of his expense accounts, Fishbein confidently announced at a luncheon on June 4, 1949, that he would be around for at least 5 more years. He counted heavily on the traditional schism between two groups at the AMA, the liberals and the conservatives, whom Fishbein declared would never be able to agree on anything. Well, he was wrong, because they did agree that he, Fishbein, should be kicked out. United by their common hatred of Morris Fishbein, they formed their conspiracy to assassinate their Caesar. In describing this episode, Martin Mayer notes that since 1944, a sizable faction of the AMA had been resolved to get Fishbein out at any cost. It had been exposed, or he had been exposed, on a national radio program called Town Meeting of the Air in early 1949 as a habitual liar. He claimed that he had been touring England, visiting the offices of general practitioners every day. The radio program revealed that he had actually been attending the Olympics, that he had dined with several members of the British aristocracy and attended a number of plays in London, and then had traveled to Paris for a round of nightclubs, all in the name of promoting medicine. The program aired on February 22, 1949, by Nelson Cruikshank, demonstrated Fishbein's reputation, noting that Fishbein had not gone near any doctor's office in England during his stay. As for Fishbein's report about his trip, Cruikshank branded it a lie, calling it a libel on a profession which is proud of its tradition of service to its patients. Fishbein's life was described as a constant round of visits to New York plays, the Stork Club, and nightclubs in London and Paris. As a result of this publicity, the AMA at its 1949 convention passed a unanimous resolution that Dr. Morris Fishbein be removed from all posts in which he did any writing and speaking. This resolution provided that he be implemented, or it be implemented, as soon as possible. That turned out to be that very afternoon. By evening, Fishbein was gone from AMA headquarters, never to return. One of the literary losses of Fishbein's departure was his column, which he had fancifully termed Dr. Pepe's Diary. It was described by one critic as a running or logarithmic account of Morris Fishbein's private life. Every Christmas, the diary was enshrined between boards and distributed as the Fishbein Christmas card to nearly everyone who had a permanent mailing address. Like all of Fishbein's extravagances, the expense of this largesse was entirely borne by the dues-paying members of the AMA. For years, Fishbein had used the awesome power of the AMA seal of acceptance to force drug companies to accede to his wishes. Harper's Magazine noted on November 1949 that the seal is probably the biggest single puller of advertising ever concocted. The journal is far and away the most profitable publication in the world. Fishbein's absolute power, he often talked as if he carried the seal in his pocket, was also the source of other men's power. Now, after Fishbein's forced departure, AMA officials moved to dilute the center of power at the Chicago headquarters. The Council on Pharmacy and Chemistry changed its name to the Council on Drugs in 1956. The seal of acceptance was dropped entirely. Ben Gaffin and Associates had reported to the AMA, the advertisers in general feel that the AMA, especially through the councils, distrusts them and views them as potential crooks who would become actively unethical if not constantly watched. This had been Fishbein's paranoid approach, but his attitude had been based on the need to maintain control and to force contributions from the ethical drug manufacturers. And as soon as the seal of acceptance was dropped, the AMA's revenues from advertisers doubled in 5 years to 10 years. In 10 years, it had tripled from $4 million to $12 million, and in retrospect, Fishbein's arrogance and his short-sighted policies had been costing the AMA millions of dollars a year in lost revenue from advertisers. Dr. Ernest Howard of the AMA offered gratuitous reasons for dropping the seal by saying that it was too arbitrary and too much authority was vested in one body. There are also certain legal problems. Now, despite the fact that Fishbein had gone and some aspects of his malign influence lingered at the AMA headquarters for years, costing the organization many millions of dollars and a great deal of unfavorable publicity. Especially virulent was Fishbein's burning determination to destroy any possibility of socialized medicine in the United States. It was paradoxical that the AMA leadership under Fishbein's dominance should be so vehemently against government intervention in the medical field, when they had used government agencies for years for their own purposes, particularly the Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Public Health Service, and the National Cancer Institute. One authority, James G. Burrow, traces the AMA's stance towards compulsory health insurance, which changed from exploratory interest to violent hostility between 1917 and 1920. This stance was justified as anti-communism, it being well known that socialized medicine had long been a primary goal of the Communist Party. A select group of prominent American leftists had been summoned to Moscow for special indoctrination in this goal. They attended a summer course at Moscow University on the organization of medicine as a state function. The group included such stalwart liberals as George S. Counts and John Dewey. On their return, they began a campaign of public agitation for national health care. Their first covert was a liberal Republican, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge. In fact, he represented the New England group of bankers who were allied with Rockefeller in maintaining the medical monopoly. On March 1, 1940, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge introduced a bill for health insurance, which provided $40 a year for health care. The bill was quickly shelved, but the gauntlet had been thrown down, and Fishbein had no intention of turning his fiefdom over to any government department. So over the next several decades, the AMA spent many millions of dollars fighting socialized medicine, all of it raised by special levies on American doctors. It also became enmeshed in several expensive antitrust cases as a result of its activities. Now, as early as 1938, the AMA had been indicted by the Department of Justice in the Group Health Association case. In 1937, a group of government employees had borrowed $40 from Homeowners Loan Company to start a group hospital. The plan offered group medical care for $26 a year for an individual or $39 a year for a family. This association, which took the name Group Health Association, hired 9 physicians. The District of Columbia Medical Society then refused these physicians permission to use the hospitals or to consult with specialists. On April 4, 1941, a jury found the American Medical Association and the District Medical Society guilty of antitrust law violations. The 2 organizations and 11 physicians had been indicted for restraint of trade. Those convicted included Dr. Morris Fishbein. 2.5 years later, the Supreme Court upheld their conviction in 1943, and a fine of $2,500 was levied. Not $52,000, $2,500. And the AMA was ordered to cease and desist in its interference with the Group Health Association. Now notice here, in 1943, they took on and they said to themselves, let's put these competitors out of business. It failed. But by 1962, now, they had perfected their technique. And they did, in fact, put most of the vitamin manufacturers out of business and the little vitamin sales pyramids out of business and all of the alternative healthcare practitioners out of business. So that 1943 caper taught them a lesson. It honed their skills for their later successes. Now, the medical monopoly in the United States is just exactly that. It's a medical monopoly. And if you take a look around the world, I think you'll find pretty much the same medical monopoly that we have here in the United States operating around the world, with the government intervening. And do you have, where you live, midwives? That'll be a test for you. Can your midwife come in and deliver your baby for you? And are you compelled to take these drugs that are prescribed by the allopathic medical physicians, or do you have any alternatives available to you? I mean, it could well be that you've got a little more freedom in your medical services than we have here in the United States. But when the governments take over, now you have a medical monopoly operated by government. Now, we Americans have been and have prided ourselves on the free enterprise system working so well in the marketplace. And the free enterprise system worked well and gave us affordable health care as long as it was market-based. But it's no longer market-based. Now, take a look at your banks and look at these bailouts that are going on. When we had a free market system in our economy, we didn't have the kind of problems and bankruptcies and bailouts that we're seeing today. But now when you have banks that are too big to fail, when you have monopolies, and they're backed by and supported by the government, now you have economic monopolies in banking, you have manufacturing monopolies in automobiles and railroads, and you have a medical monopoly with the pharmaceutical companies and the AMA. And these monopolies are opposed to our constitutional free market system. So if you want to know what's wrong in America, it's the demise of the free market system. It is the replacement of the Ten Commandments by the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. That's what your problem is. Now, the American Medical Association fared little better in its 20-year battle against Medicare. The preservation of the integrity of the local physician was a worthwhile goal. However, he was already under the control of the Rockefeller medical monopoly, and it's difficult to see how the establishment of socialized medicine in the United States would change anything, nor has it. Time magazine noted on December 10, 1948, that the American Medical Association had assessed each of its members $25 for a campaign to spend $3.5 million on medical education, a campaign to turn people against socialized medicine. Let's see here. It was the first such assessment of the AMA in its 100 years of operation. Now, almost two decades later, the Saturday Evening Post noted in its issue of January 1, 1966, that the AMA had spent $5 million in 1964 and 65. Battling the Medicare lobby in Washington, it was noted that the AMA had $23 million of income that year from its annual dues. The dues at that time were $45 a year. And from the sales of advertisements in the AMA publications to drug companies and medical supply houses. Time, on December 1, 1978, noted that Judge Fred Barnes, administrative law judge at the Federal Trade Commission, had ruled that the AMA Code of Ethics illegally restrains competition among doctors by preventing them from advertising. He further ruled that AMA ethical guidelines should be the future, or in the future, be approved by the FTC. The AMA issued an indignant press release opposing the decision. There is no legal precedent in the United States for the federal bureaucracy to write or approve a code of ethics for any of the learned professions. I got to pause here and make an observation. The AMA, when it's controlling through its monopoly, never had any precedent. And then they went ahead and created their monopoly and operated it. Now, when the government comes in and says, hey, wait a minute, here's a court now, says, hey, wait a minute, now you're restraining trade, they get real indignant. I call that hypocrisy. The subject of the AMA Code of Ethics had already come up several times. Science Magazine noted on June 21, 1940, on the Bureau of Investigation of Frauds and Charlatans that the question was raised, should medical ethics be changed? The principle of medical ethics as set down at present can be improved in wording and arrangement, but it also believes that the present is not the time to do the rewriting. It seems wise to let the muddied waters settle before any consideration is given to so fundamental nature of our organization as our principles of medical ethics. And although the speaker was not identified, this pious pronunciation or pronouncement could only have come from Fishbein himself. The speaker goes on to admit, rather coyly, that the principle of medical ethics can be improved, but that ended the matter. The passage of Medicare after the AMA had spent or sent so many millions opposing it apparently changed nothing. It proved to be an unexpected windfall for many of the more unscrupulous members of the medical profession. They had no problem in padding bills for fees to the tune of millions of dollars per year per practitioner. In 1982, Medicare paid out some $48.3 billion, while Medicaid paid out $38 billion. The more conservative estimates believe that some $11 billion of these funds were skimmed in illegal profits. The heirs of Morris Fishbein at the AMA may have lost the battle to stop socialized medicine, but they have certainly won the war. As we previously noted, the AMA trustees at a meeting on November 2, 1963, resolved to eliminate chiropractic, their biggest rival, through a committee on quackery. The secretary of this committee reported back to the trustees on January 4, 1971, that its prime mission, first the containment of chiropractic and ultimately the elimination of chiropractic, a more blatant admission of conspiracy can hardly be found in any organization's records. The committee's special investigative unit, headed by the general counsel of the AMA, Robert Throckmorton, involved using insurance companies, hospitals, state medical licensing boards, public and private colleges, and lobbyists. Every method of intimidation and censorship was used. Dr. Philip Weinstein, a California neurologist, had given many lectures to chiropractic groups on diagnosing illness of the spine. The AMA ordered him to stop all such appearances. He sent a note of apology after canceling a forthcoming lecture. Please accept our sincerest apologies for this late cancellation. Due to circumstances beyond our control, we're unaware that delivering medical lectures to your organization was prohibited. Well, they became prohibited when the AMA decided to declare war on the chiropractors and put them out of business. Well, all right, so much for that portion of the program. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now it's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, you can also download our free General Law CD package from our website on our archives page at georgegordon.org or georgegordon.com. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're taking a look here at quacks and quackery. Might as well tell you where to go get a copy of the book. It's called Murder by Injection, The Story of the Medical Conspiracy Against America by Eustace Mullins. Published first in 1988. Second printing, 1992. 10 chapters. This is chapter 2, deals with quacks and quackery. And here I'm showing you that the quacks in the AMA have taken over, used the government to destroy all of their competitors by branding them quacks. It's a proven strategy. You attack your opponent, and you attack him personally, and you attack him professionally. And by attacking him, you say, hey, this guy over here is a dirty, no good, low down, and let me tell you the straight skinny about him, and you want to avoid him like AIDS, herpes, and VD. By being the first guy to attack, we believe what we are told. It's much more difficult to defend after the attack has been levied. It's oftentimes better for you to attack your opponent first. And the AMA took a look at their competitors and said, hey, listen, we want to drive them out of business. Now, the competitors, you know, the little mom and pop, the independent physicians, the homeopaths, the naturopaths, the chiropractics, see, they didn't have a big organization like the AMA. They didn't have a national organization. It's like the National Education Association, the NEA, with the teachers. See, they're big and ponderous. They've got control of the schools. The little schools aren't trying to put the public schools out of business. It's the public schools trying to hog education and put the parochial schools out of business, to put the homeschoolers out of business. So in the 1980s, they attacked homeschoolers, just like the AMA attacked chiropractors and alternative health practitioners. In the case of the NEA, it didn't work. There were so many homeschoolers, there were so many parents that were so fed up with the public school system that they fought it on a case-by-case basis. And it got to be so expensive and so redundant. And constitutionally, it was a no-brainer. And the homeschoolers won out. Now, they've taken a different tactic. So now they tolerate the homeschoolers, but their thrust is at controlling the homeschoolers through curriculum, through regulation. They're going to regulate them to death, like they do in Pennsylvania. And now the medical association was more direct, and their assault on the individual practitioners, once they branded them as quacks, the American public sat back and watched and said, oh my God, I didn't know that there were all of these quacks profiting off of us. And it was a good strategy. Old John D. Rockefeller did that. He was a criminal. He was a crook. And he had a really bad reputation. So one day, he went to his public relations firm and said, what do we do to get over this bad reputation that I have? And they said, well, we've got to get into philanthropy because everybody likes somebody who's giving. So they came up with a gimmick, and the gimmick worked like a shot. Old John D. Rockefeller bought rolls of dimes. And when he went out in public, especially when he went around to schools, he would throw dimes, rolls of dimes. He'd open them up and throw the dimes out, and the kids would run out and grab all these dimes. For a few thousand dollars, John D. Rockefeller bought more good public relations than he could with millions of dollars of advertising and lies. Just threw dimes to the kids. McDonald's has picked up on that. The rest of the fast food restaurants haven't picked up on McDonald's success. It's their playground. 60 Minutes had a memorial for Don Hewitt. And Don Hewitt was asked, what is it that makes 60 Minutes so successful? And he said, it's very simple. Tell them a story. It's what every kid wants to hear. Tell them a story. Everybody wants to learn. Everybody wants to hear. So in journalism, tell them a story. But in marketing, you want to give them a leader. Walmart is a genius at the leader. So they put things out there that are at cost. And the people come in to buy those things at cost. Hey, nobody walks into a store to buy the leader. That's what drew you into the store. Nobody leaves the store with just the leader. When my wife goes into Walmart, she always spends $100. I was watching her the other day. I've never seen that woman come out of Walmart with less than $100 to $200. And she likes those leaders. And she walks into the store and she buys those cheap thingies that brought her into the store. But while she's there, I might as well pick up the bananas and I might as well get the frozen strawberries. And those are not on sale. Those are not leaders. And Walmart's just as competitive as anybody else, but they're getting their full markup on them, just like the other stores are. John D. Rockefeller did it. The American Medical Association has done it. And it all has to do with this thing of public relations. And the American Medical Association has been craftier than have their opponents. It's like Walmart is craftier than their opponents. The thing that's always amazed me is that their opponents, that is Target and Kmart and the rest of them, ought to take a page out of Walmart's store. The alternative medical associations over here, the National Institute of Health, I think it's the National Health Federation, which is the alternative to the AMA. I sometimes get screwed up on all these letters and alphabet soups that are running around here, but there's the National Health Federation, I believe, is the alternative health care group in opposition to the AMA. Now, the difference is that the AMA is staffed by thieves, criminals, and charlatans. And the normal people out in society who aren't the thieves, the frauds, and the charlatans are unable to use the same kind of underhanded, unethical criminal strategies and techniques against their opponents. So they're fighting a war with one hand tied behind their back. Throckmorton also tried to put chiropractic schools out of business by preventing the government from granting guaranteed student loans or grants from the government for research at chiropractic colleges. Throckmorton prevented them from getting accreditation, lobbied in every state to prevent the establishment of a government-created accreditation body, and was furious when the Health Education and Welfare Office of Education became an agency of educators rather than physicians. Resisted his efforts and in 1974 sanctioned the Council on Chiropractic Education as a national accreditation body for chiropractic schools. The AMA brought pressure on CW Post University, a division of Long Island University, to drop a course designed for pre-chiropractic students in 1972. In the late 60s, the AMA Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospitals imposed new requirements on hospitals. The AMA Principles of Medical Ethics barred its members from all forms of exchange with chiropractors. And a JCAH letter, August 13, 1973, to a hospital administrator declared that any arrangement you would make with chiropractors and your hospital would be unacceptable to the Joint Committee. This would be in violation of the principles of medical ethics published by the AMA that is also a requirement of the JCAH. On January 9, 1973, the JCAH wrote in a hospital, or to a hospital in Silver City, New Mexico, "This is in answer to your letter of December 18th referring to a bill which may be passed in New Mexico that hospitals must accept chiropractors as members of the medical staff. You're absolutely correct. The unfortunate results of this most ill-advised legislation means that the Joint Committee could withdraw and refuse accreditation of the hospital that had chiropractors on its staff. The AMA then forced the Veterans Administration to refuse payments to veterans for chiropractic services. It's these kinds of tactics that had been reported to the AMA as positive results. A confidential memorandum dated September 21, 1967, by the Committee on Quackery boasted to the trustees that basically the committee's short-range objectives for containing the cult of chiropractic. God, I've got to underline that. I get called a cult leader every once in a while. Here's the cult of chiropractic. Hey, all you chiropractors out there, did you know that you were cults? Cults. How do you like that? See, cult and quack are those singular, simple, one-syllable words that describe wickedness and evil in a nutshell. Doesn't it? Cult, quack, evil. And any additional recognition that it might achieve resolves around four points. Doing everything within our power to see that chiropractic coverage under Title 18 of the Medicare law is not obtained. Doing everything within our power to see that registration or a listing within the U.S. Office of Education or the establishment of a chiropractic accrediting agency is not achieved. And three, to encourage continued separation of the two national chiropractic associations. And four, encourage state medical societies to take the initiative in their state legislature with regard to legislation that might affect the practice of chiropractic. See what they're doing here? This is back in the 60s and 70s. See, they just targeted the chiropractors and said, we want to destroy them. And so they spent millions of dollars in their efforts. This is like political intrigue between the KGB and the CIA. And you've got a target country, and you go in there, and what you're trying to do here is to win over the general population, get the people of the country onto your side, one side or the other. Now, because of the flagrant activities of the AMA, several chiropractors finally sued, charging conspiracy. The case dragged on for years. But on August the 27th, 1987, after 11 years of continuous litigation, federal judge Susan Getzendammer of the U.S. District Court found the American Medical Association and the American College of Surgeons and the American College of Radiologists guilty of conspiracy to destroy the profession of chiropractic. During the proceedings, the AMA freely acknowledged that they never had, nor have any knowledge of the content or the quality of the courses taught in chiropractic college. I'm going to underline that. That's pretty important. Let me read it to you again. A lawsuit that lasted 11 years, brought by several independent chiropractors against the AMA, the American College of Surgeons and the American College of Radiologists, charged that they were acting in a conspiracy to destroy our business. So after 11 years goes by, the judge comes down and says, yep, that's correct. But as a result of the trial, the American Medical Association freely acknowledged that they had never at any time looked into chiropractic to see if it had any medical benefits. We're going to destroy you, but we don't have any idea whether or not what you're doing is good, bad, or indifferent. Now, what that demonstrates to us is this, that the American Medical Association has no interest in medical practice. They have interest in making money through a monopoly. Pure and simple. Now, when we took up cancer here last week, we can come to the same conclusion, The American Cancer Society has no interest in a cure for cancer, doesn't care whether anybody else can cure it or not. All they know is it's a money-making deal, and we don't want any competition. And so they're working hard to prevent the competition. Now they've got dupes everywhere running for cancer. I was watching the news last night, and they got a thingy going up here in Springfield. And they're always running or marching. They're running or marching, you know, for cancer. And where they got the Harley-Davidson guys out here, you know, I don't know if they're called the Hell's Angels here in Missouri, but they got motorcycle clubs, and they got the motorcycle guys out here riding for cancer, raising money for cancer research. It's a hell of a ploy. And it's public, and it makes all of us feel good. My God, these people are out here working hard. They're doing something. They're doing something. What they're doing isn't good for any of us, but by God, they're out here doing something. Has it ever occurred to us that maybe we ought to sit down, shut up, and fold our hands, and doing absolutely nothing would be better for us? Has it ever occurred to anybody? Don't do anything. Doing nothing will solve our problem. That's the way it is in economics. See, everybody's impressed with Ben Bernanke and Tim Gaither because they're doing something. Damn right they are. They're spending trillions of dollars bailing out big banks and looting the treasury and destroying our economy. They are doing something. By God, they're active. But what they're doing is destroying the economy, which is bad for 300 million Americans. But it's good for a few thousand bankers. These laws being enacted here to bail out AIG and Freddie Mac and Ginnie Mae and Goldman Sachs and Bank of America, my God, those are good laws. That's good legislation. I wouldn't condemn it, but what in the hell is it doing for you? Didn't do anything for me. I don't give a damn whether Bank of America lives or dies, survives, or goes upside down. I don't have any stock in Bank of America. No skin off my ass one way or the other. Now, the government came in and said, hey, we got to save this. No, the best thing that anybody could do is absolutely nothing. Let the economy go down to zero. You know, the ultimate end to the house price problem is that it's got to reach bottom. If you do nothing, it'll reach bottom in about 30 days. If you intervene, it'll reach bottom in about 3 to 5 years. Now, did you want to stumble along here in economic collapse and near collapse and befoggery for about 3 to 5 years? You want to get the damn thing over again so that we can get on with life. That's a choice we have to make. Now, we Americans have made our choice. We want to stumble along for 3 to 5 years, bailing out banks and spending trillions of dollars, impoverishing ourselves and putting our children in debt for hundreds of years and creating feudal serfdom in the process. That's the choice we wanted. That's the choice we've made. And by God, now there's going to have to be a time when we face reality, and there's going to be an outcome to that. So the AMA here, he was often heard to refer contemptuously to Der Schwarzers. That's a Yiddish term of contempt for blacks whenever the subject of admitting blacks came up, as it did repeatedly during his regime. Now, these guys were opposed to black doctors. This AMA was a racist operation till about 1954. Well, Judge Getzendammer wrote a 101-page opinion and issued an order of permanent injunction requiring the AMA to cease and desist from restricting, regulating, or impeding, or aiding and abetting others from restricting, regulating, and impeding the freedom of any AMA member or any institution or hospital to make an individual decision as to whether or not the AMA member, institution, or hospital shall professionally associate with chiropractors, chiropractic students, or chiropractic institutions. Thus ended the legacy of malice and obstructionism which Morris Fishbein had left to the AMA. Although he had been formally relieved of all duties at the 98th meeting of the AMA on June 20, 1949, the AMA had been bedeviled by his obsessions for four more decades. Another of his obsessions was his refusal to admit any black physicians as members of the AMA, and he was often heard to refer contemptuously to Der Schwarzers. It's a Yiddish term of contempt for blacks. Whenever the subject of admitting blacks came up, as it did repeatedly during his regime, his policy continued at the AMA for two more decades until 1968, when the AMA was forced to admit blacks. And previously, the blacks had maintained their own organization. It was called the National Medical Association, and in hailing the decision, Time referred patronizingly to the Moss-backed AMA. Now, the fact that Simmons and Fishbein were able to impose their petty concerns on this national organization for half a century reflects little credit on its members. One of the most telling comments was made by T. Swan Hardy in the Forum in June of 1929 in an article with the title, How Scientific Are Our Doctors? And Hardy wrote, Medicine as a profession is not distinguished for the mentality of its members. The average intelligence is lower than in perhaps any other profession. Organized medicine in America is unalterably opposed to any standard of reorganization which would, one, make the medical monopoly thoroughly scientific, and two, make such therapy generally available to all who need it, and three, menace the incomes of incompetent practitioners. And it's noteworthy that the insignia of the medical profession is two snakes entwined on a staff. However, the University of Rochester, deciding that this was excessive, recently reduced the two snakes to one snake, and the caduceus is the mythological symbol of the Roman god Mercury. He was the patron of messengers, but he also had a somewhat unsavory reputation as the associate of outlaws, merchants, and thieves. Well, in the ancient world, merchants were synonymous with the other two categories, which just happens to fit the AMA. Now, notice here, as early as 1929, this good doctor, Dr. Hardy, said, hey, how scientific is our profession? The medical monopoly is not scientific. They claim to be. Oh my God, they're out here just bantying about science, and we're just as scientific as we can be. They're about as scientific as a voodoo witch doctor shaking bat's knuckles under the full moon doing incantations. That's what we're dealing with the medical monopoly. It is true, there is some science there, but the science is damn little and few and far between. Well, that's about the end of that story. Remember, this now is called Murder by Injection. You get a copy of it from BraveNewBookstore.com. You've been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, nonprofit, non-commercial, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.